Okay, I'm going to call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that the time is currently 9:21 a.m. on Thursday, March 23rd, 2017. Present today, we have Representative Ortiz, Representative Kawasaki, Representative Wilson, Vice Chair Guerra, Co-Chair Seaton, Representative Tilton, Representative Grin, Representative Guttenberg, and myself, Co-Chair Foster. And before we start, reminder, please mute your phones. At this meeting, we'll be addressing a CS committee substitute for HB 115, which is the income tax and the PFD credit permanent fund income bill. This morning we have a CS for 115 before us, and Co-Chair Seaton, can I have a motion to bring the CS for HB 115 version 30-LS0125/L for Lima before the committee for discussion?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the CS for 115 version L before the committee for discussion.
Okay, and at this, any objection for discussion purposes?
Yeah.
Thank you. Okay, at this time, I'd like to ask Co-Chair Seaton's aide, Tanika Hansen, to come to the table and walk the committee through the CS.
You don't need it.
Okay. 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 And Tanika, if you could put yourself on the record and proceed.
For the record, Tanika Hansen, staff to Representative Seaton.
And just quickly, I want to also note that we do have available for questions on the telephone Brandon Spanos. He's with the Department of Revenue. So, Ms. Hansen.
So, this CS incorporates the changes that were made by the amendments that the committee passed, and then it also incorporates a new income tax section. So I'm going to first go through quickly the summary of changes that relate to the amendments that we already adopted, and then I'll get into kind of an overview on the income tax change. So there are several new sections that came out of the amendments we adopted. There's some title changes. We've added relating to the permanent fund, relating to the procurement by the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation, relating to the management of the Budget Reserve Fund. And then among five of the title, the individuals, partners, shareholders, and S corporations, trusts, and estates was added to the description of the income tax. Section 2 is a new section. And it's directing the trustees of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation to adopt regulations relating to procurement. So that was Amendment 11 by Representative Pruitt. And Section 3 is also from that same amendment, adding the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation to the list of entities that are excluded from the definition of agency for the purpose of the state procurement code. Section 4 is also a new section, but it's conforming to changes made in new Section 6, and these relate to Amendment Number 5, which was changing the royalties, taking the bonus royalties over the constitutionally required 25%, and so that those extra 25% of royalties now stays in the general fund instead of going to the permanent fund. So Section 4 is amending a paragraph that references the Marine Highway Fund, but it's just amending it to delete the reference to 3713010A2, which is being, that because that subsection is being deleted in Section 6. Section 5 is a new section, and this is the one that relates to the subaccount in the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund to remove the requirement that any funds invested in the subaccount be assumed to be unneeded for the next 5 years. That was Amendment Number 12. Section 8 amends the amount available for distribution from the Earnings Reserve Fund. This is the percent of market value section that defines how that'll be calculated. The original bill had that amount set at 4.75% of market value. This Section 8 takes that amount up to 5.25. And that will be effective basically through fiscal year 8. I think I have a typo there, but it's supposed to be through fiscal years 18 and 19. Section 9 is amending that same section, and so these were both from Amendment Number 1. Section 9 amends that new section to change that rate from 5.25 to 5%, and that will be effective July 1st, 2019. Section 10 adds to the Section 3713-145B, which is where we described how the earnings from how the earnings reserve account money will be distributed. And so this is just adding that additional 0.25% of market value that will be transferred from the earnings reserve account into the principal. This transfer does not come out of that 5.25% of market value calculation. It's a separate calculation. It's an internal transfer within the fund itself, and that was from Amendment 1. And Section 12 has been amended. 3713-145 subsection E was in the original bill. This is the four times the draw, when the earnings reserve is four times the draw, then the excess would go into the permanent fund principal. Amendment 7 made changes to that to clarify that that transfer would be the lesser of the amount that's above that four times the draw or the amount necessary to offset the cumulative effect of inflation since the last time the fund was inflation-proof. And so that was Amendment 7. We also have a new subsection F. And this is from Amendment 3, and it relates to the dividend amount of $1,250 for fiscal years 18 and 19. So this subsection F directs the legislature to appropriate the additional money, if any, to make sure that the dividend will be that amount for those 2 years. And then that subsection will be repealed at the end of the fiscal year 2019. And Section 13 is also related to Amendment Number 3 dealing with the minimum dividend amount. Starting on June 30th, 2020, which is the beginning of the next fiscal year, that section will be amended to remove subsection F, talking about the minimum dividend, and you have to then remove the references to that subsection. So it's just conforming to the repeal of that 2-year minimum dividend. Section 16 and 17 both relate to the income tax, and so these changes were not through any of the amendments that were taken directly in committee. Section 16 is just dealing with the exemption from the requirement to file electronically. That was the original Section 10. It just was amended to reference the correct section in the new income tax. And Section 17, which was originally Section 11 in House Bill 115, has been amended. All the subsections have been amended to shift from a tax based on federal tax liability into adjusted gross. And I would be happy to come back to that section briefly. We got a couple more sections related to the other amendments.
But Mr. Chairman, just real quick. Just a quick question. Where did this language come from? Because I know it wasn't an amendment. Did this come from revenue? Was this pulled out from other states? Where did this language that now that we're going to go to brackets instead, where did that come from?
It came out, we were working with the Department of Revenue to get the type of language that they would need in order to implement an effective tax, but it also came out of testimony and public comment. Mr. King and Professor, his name starts with a T, but I've forgotten who, with ICER, who was here presenting on the same day as King, both referenced the potential volatility of using a tax based on federal tax liability, because if the federal tax brackets were to change or if they were to change their deductions substantially, things like that, then our revenues would likewise shift based on their change. We've also had comment from some of the public members who were concerned with what they felt like were deductions and credits that are incorporated into federal tax liability that they don't necessarily feel like are the best income, best tax system. And we've also had some concern with the original in the original version of the bill, which was based on federal tax liability, we had an additional 10% tax on capital gains in an attempt to even out the tax rates between long-term capital gains and other income sources. That 10% tax wasn't quite achieving what we wanted to. It was actually a higher tax on capital gains than we were intending. By going up from adjusted gross income instead of federal tax liability, that's before the lower tax rate on long-term capital gains is applied. So under adjusted gross income, capital gains are treated just like any other income. And so in that sense, by going here, it makes it simpler. We don't have to create a separate tax on capital gains to make up for the lower federal tax on capital gains. They're just all income is taxed at the same rate.
I just kind of want to see where the language was. I know we'll have more discussion on it, but I just kind of didn't know where it came from.
Sure. And just to be clear, you know, when the testimony was pretty much that we should go to adjusted gross income, the administration had had a consultant that had worked on an adjusted gross tax bill earlier. And so some of that language has been incorporated in here. And so we worked with the administration as well with their language, because they had had actually a national consultant on state taxes draft language. And so it's much better than us just creating something out of, you know, out of the air. So we have, there's an actual consultant that worked on an adjusted gross income tax portion. And so much of that is incorporated in here. There's been a lot of changes as well, anyway.
Mr. Chair, and so the testimony we're talking about is mostly invited testimony that we received, because that's who we had in front of us. I know we had testimony on the capital gains portion of it, but I mean as far as the bracketing. And so this other chart that we have in here, Mr. Chairman, is accurate based on we went from not having an income tax to being the fourth highest of all the states. So I'm assuming that's what this other sheet that was in our packet was.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, it's fourth lowest.
Fourth lowest?
Yeah.
Okay, perfect.
Which is where...
Rank one through four, it's usually...
Right, yeah. And that's...
Normally don't start with the lowest and work our way down.
And that is the same place that the tax on federal... the previous version on federal tax liability would have placed it. If you go by the brackets, there's... You know, depends on what bracket you're talking about, but the average, it's the same ranking.
I think Representative Garrett, did you have something?
Yeah, through the chair. Just on page 7, Ms. Hansen, and by the way, you've been working long hours, so thank you, like a lot of people in the building, but thank you. I've seen you here very late. If we're doing the calculations, and you and I have talked about this, but you don't pay a tax at less than $10,300 in income, but that's really $14,300 in income. And for somebody just reading the bill, they wouldn't know that. And can you explain why that's $14,300, not $10,300?
Sure. Representative Garrett, through the chair. I'll get into this in more detail after we finish with the summary of changes, but essentially – the brackets apply to the income that is considered taxable. This bill includes a personal exemption of $400,000 per person, just as that we have a... That's one of the first things that go that goes when my brain gets tired. $400,000 per person. I'm sorry.
You're going to get us in trouble.
I know. It's $4,000 per person. Just as you have a per-person exemption on the federal level. And so you would take that $400,000 out, or $800,000 if you're filing jointly or have dependents, et cetera, before you even apply any of the tax brackets.
And
I like the 400,000.
Yes, you're wrong. My staff is working late preparing the things. We just got things back from the draft.
Yeah, so yeah, and I please do not hesitate to ask me about numbers, because I know I that is one of my quirks, that when I get tired, I tend to concentrate on the very first number and add or subtract zeros. So,
like your math
better. Representative Guerra.
Thank you. And I'm sure Representative Seatnell will let you sleep sometime in June, so that should be okay. Apart from the fact that I would like a 35% tax credit in my income tax, let me just the math so people understand. And if it's feasible, I think I'd like a real schedule, so people don't think they're getting taxed at $10,300 when they're really not.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if it's feasible. We'll find out, I guess, from the Department of Revenue. But just so people know, if it's a 2.5%, and help me if I'm doing my math right, if it's a 2.5% for just that income above $14,300, so if you made $16,000, that would be 2.5% of $1,700. That would be about a $40 tax that somebody with at $17,000 would pay. Is that correct?
And what we'll do is we'll get a table, so she's not trying to calculate numbers in.
I think it's about a $40 tax.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. But
that's fair enough. You're right. We should we'll get a table.
Representative Guerra, through the chair, we have similar to the example chart we had for the federal tax liability, we are in the process of updating that for this new version, and then somebody would be able to say, okay, what's my gross income, then the deduction will be applied, the exemption for the dividend, etc., and then you get down to what you owe. So yeah, we will have that chart shortly, and so people won't have to do the calculations.
And before we go forward, I want to recognize that Sullivan Leonard's joined us. Thank you.
Mr. Just
but I don't want to get in.
We won't do that.
I don't want to get her through the bill.
Just so it's clear to folks, if you made $14,300, you're not paying taxes on that first $14,300. That's all tax-free. It's the amount of income above that level that the tax rate applies to, correct?
Correct. And similarly, if you're in the next tax bracket, you're not paying 4% on all of your income. You're only paying 4% on the amount of your income that is above $50,000, which is the same way that the federal tax brackets work. We will have a chart that explains that, but I'll also come back to that and restate it. So moving past the income tax section briefly to finish up the amendments that we took in committee, we have a new section 18. This adds to the to 4323.025, which relates to how the dividend is calculated. And this simply states that the amount of the dividend for fiscal years 18 and 19 will be at least $1,250. So that's that minimum dividend for the next 2 years, and then this new section C stating that that's going to be the minimum dividend will be repealed at the end of fiscal year 19. New section 19 is a lengthy section, but it only makes a change to one line to clarify that the Department of Revenue will annually pay the permanent fund dividends from the dividend fund without further appropriation. This was Amendment 6, which Mr. Teal testified on. This is what the legislature has been doing, is just assuming that the dividends are appropriated out of that fund. But this just clarifies it in statute. Section 23 is a new section, and this just repeals AS 3713145F and AS 4323025C. These are those two temporary sections created relating to the $1,250 minimum dividend for fiscal years 18 and 19. So those two subsections are repealed at the end of fiscal year 19.
Sure.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. So in the new Section 20, where we're asking the department to put a place on the application, the ballot initiative on voting is not affected by this at all. Voter registration is not affected by this at all.
Representative Guttenberg for the chair. Yes, Section 20 and that section, it's been renumbered, but it was in the original bill. This relates to the income tax, and it's allowing them to choose to pay a portion or all of their tax liability using their dividend, and it should not affect that. It's just adding another a checkbox to the application.
Thank you. Just wanted to make sure that's on the record.
New Section 24, this was created by Amendment 2. This relates to the FY17 draw specifically. It's placed in uncodified law, and it just states that the amount available in fiscal year 17 is 5.25% of the market value minus the amount that was already paid out in 2017 for the dividends. And this section has an immediate effective date. Section 26 is the transition language section. Section A relating to the department was already in the bill. New subsection B has been added to allow the Commissioner of Revenue and Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation to adopt the necessary regulations. This came out of Amendment 11 relating to the Procurement Act. And then sections 27 through 33, the effective date sections, there were several changes there because we renumbered most of the bill sections, and so the effective date sections had to be renumbered. The effective date of the original bill was, there were two primary effective dates in the original bill. The first one was an immediate effective date, and then the other primary one was January 1st, 2018. Now the only section that has an immediate effective date is Section 24 and related sections. Also Section 1, which is just the title of the act, the State Revenue Restructuring Act. The effective date of the rest of the bill that isn't given a specific effective date is now July 1st, 2017. And that was a change in effective dates that came out of I believe Amendment 2, but I'd have to look at the amendment relating to Section 24. The effective date of the income tax in the original version was January 1st, 2018. The effective date of the income tax in this section was January 1st, 2019. That we'll have the Department of Revenue available next week to speak to lots of items in this bill. That was their preferred effective date all along to allow them to have the necessary time to update their software. So the change to the effective date isn't a reflection of any of this new tax section being more complicated. In fact, I believe they would testify that it's going to be easier for them to implement and easier for them to write regulations. It was their preferred effective date, 2019. And I did want to note one of the effective dates relating to Amendment 11, the Procurement Act. In the amendment, the effective dates for those sections there wasn't a specific effective date for those sections, so they were given the effective date of the general bill, which was January 1st, 2018, the effective date of the general bill. I don't think that was necessarily your intended effective date for those sections, so we'd be happy to work with you and figure out a more appropriate effective date, but that is the effective date in this new draft of the bill currently.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Tanika. It's sooner the better that they get that. It's fine, so we'll work on that. Thanks.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I hate to bring the $408,000 back up, but I can't find it.
Okay.
Can you tell me which section it's actually in?
Sure. You're in the bill itself?
Yes.
Yeah. So the exemption is in section 4322.030. This is, that section starts on page 11, but it's what you're looking for is actually on page 12, line 8.
And a follow-up, Mr. Chairman? And do you know if there's a reason why this is for non-residents as well as residents? Why? Because it's my understanding that when it comes to exemptions, we can make a difference versus non-residents and residents. We can on the tax rate, but I know other states make those kinds of, where they equal things out, it's usually in deductions.
Sure. Representative Wilson through the chair. Mr. Spanos can speak to this more directly. On Tuesday, we're going to have the Department of Revenue. We're planning on having the Department of Revenue here for the whole meeting. But we looked into this carefully, and you can't offer a deduction for a resident that you then don't offer to another, to a non-resident. It's an equal protection thing. You can, if you make it specifically for certain things, so like we've exempted the permanent fund dividend, which effectively is only a deduction for residents because they are the only people who get the dividend. Similarly, I believe it is, I have to look, but I believe it is Vermont does have a deduction that relates specifically to resident property owners, but we've been told that that makes their tax extremely complicated. That specific deduction.
Mr. Chairman, I could wait until Tuesday, and I'll bring back the examples, and I'm pretty sure that do that. But if we're going to have somebody here on Tuesday, then that works for me.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And just to kind of follow up on that, we asked about it. What I was told is you can't not offer them the deduction. However, our intention is that the in the same way that a non-resident reduces their income by based on the amount of income that they have in-state and out-of-state, the value of their deduction may be reduced as well. But I will have to follow up on that with Mr. Spanos.
Thank you. That works.
All right. So if there are no questions on the changes related to the amendments, I'd be happy to move to a kind of high-level summary of the income tax section. So as was already stated previously, that the idea for moving to adjusted gross came out of testimony, both from the invited testimony from Mr. King and Professor Townsend, I believe is his name, also from correspondence that we received through public testimony and through emailed public testimony. A couple of CPAs said that adjusted gross would be a better place to start. We received a lot of testimony on the capital gains section, and this really is a much simpler way to approach the capital gains section, and that is how the majority of states do it. A couple of states do taxable income, but I think it's four, and none of them do tax liability. And way back when Alaska first had its original income tax, that one was based on federal tax liability. The tax codes, you know, nationally and everything were different then. And actually, we did shift from federal tax liability to a bracketed system based on taxable income. It's sort of similar to this. In 1975 was when that switch was made, and part of that came out of in the 60s there was a significant change to the federal tax brackets, which reduced Alaska's income quite a bit, and so in response they looked at changing what we were basing our taxes on. And one benefit that changing from federal tax liability to adjusted gross income is that we can do things such as exempt the dividend. We can't change the dividend's tax status on the federal level because income, you know, it's considered income. But we have heard from some experts that we should be able to exempt it on the state level, which when we were going off of tax federal tax liability, the dividend was included into your total tax liability, and so the 15% tax, 15% of your federal tax liability was also applying to the dividend.
So if we're going to have this later on in the week, you know, I just kind of want to put it on the record. So I hope we're going to talk a little bit more about trusts and corporations and how, because I know trust was out of this and now it appears to be in it. And I was reading through, you know, whether or not your trust is in this state or out of this state. It's my understanding, too, that we have a lot of people, companies have come here because of the way our trust rules are and how that would affect it. But on the corporation part of it, it's also my understanding that if I took the top 10 corporations, the first nine would be exempt because they're exempt under federal law for native corporations. So we'd get number 10 when we get to Linden. So if we're going to, because again, you can't overdo the federal law, so there's nothing we could do about that. But what kind of disadvantage are we putting some of our corporations, because some will be exempt because of federal law, but now they'll fall underneath this, and how much tax does that add? So I hope we have some kind of, you know, how that all goes, since I think a lot of states don't have that issue.
Sure.
But we have some pretty rich corporations that will be exempt from this tax.
Well, all corporations will be exempt from the tax.
All C corporations will be exempt, but personal pass-through corporations, S corporations, partnerships, LLCs, will be included in this tax.
Yeah. Yeah. This is a personal income tax, not a corporate income tax. So corporate income, meaning C corporations, are not handled in this bill at all. This is only a personal income tax that does apply to S corporations, which pass their money to individuals. So the individuals receive that as individual income or partnership. So but what I'd like to do is I'd like you to go through the income tax instead of us
trying
to talk about a little.
Sure.
Let's just go right through section 17, I think, is where we are, and go through the entire income tax and how it's structured and what each one of those subsections.
Sure. Just a couple of overview points that I wanted to put out before I go through the sectional. Again, as we talked about, the tax brackets apply to your taxable income, so we'll have a chart showing that. That's after the deductions that are allowed in this section, so it's not actually exactly off of what you make. Really, the key sections that you may want to look at, and then I'll speak to them, are 4322.010, that's where it establishes the tax brackets. 4322.030, which is defining the taxable income, and that's also where the exemption is. 4322.045, that's defining Alaska source income, so basically what residents would be taxed on, what non-residents would be taxed on, because it's defining what income is considered from within the state. And 4322.150, which is the definitions for the whole section, and the important definitions in there include resident, you know, who's going to be taxed as a resident. And then in general, sections 070 through 095 are administrative sections and are similar to sections that were in the original 115. And sections 040, 050, 055, 060, and 065 just provide guidance and authority to the department on specific situations that were already considered, in both versions of the bill, were considered taxable groups, but because when dealing with partnerships, you have the distributive share, just saying very clearly that the income for those groups will be allocated as it is on the federal level. So. If we go, section 17 starts on page 7. And the first is Section 4322.010. This defines the income tax on individuals. It defines the tax brackets. And the income tax will be on a resident or on a non-resident based on income derived from or connected to a source in the state. The tax for individuals is in Section B, so that starts with the bottom tax bracket is $10,300. The tax for income under that is zero, and then above that it'll be 2.5% of any income that is above that amount, and again that, this is after the exemption and so on, and the totals that you see on the right hand side are basically just saying, you know, the first bracket is 50,000 minus 10,300, that's the taxable income in that bracket, times 2.5% equals that first total there. And so in the next bracket it's saying you've been taxed on this first group of income in that lower bracket, that's equal to $992, and then income that is above that is going to be taxed at 0.4%. This is how the federal tax brackets work, where you're each income amount is taxed at its equivalent bracket, so you're not taxing all of your income at whatever your highest tax rate is. It's just whatever portion of that income is in that highest bracket.
Thank you. So we've got the schedule for individual payers and then joint payers, and then we don't have a schedule for like the number of dependents you have, but that's just an extra $4,000 for each dependent. Is that how that works?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, yes, that's correct.
All right, thanks.
So Section C is the brackets for the married, or for filing jointly, which is generally considered a married couple. Anybody who is eligible to file a federal joint return could be eligible to file in this bracket. I would note that there is a small typo. It's intended that this bottom bracket be just a doubling of the individual bracket, since you have two individuals who are filing, so you double the income. And we currently have it written down as 2,200 or 22,600, so it should just be 2,600. And then D and E both deal with.
Good. Mm-hmm. I just meant, did everybody make that correction? That's on line 8 on page 8. That should be 20,600, not 22,600.
And that will affect.
And that will carry through the other tax rate by $2,000.
Yeah.
That will be corrected in the next version.
It's a difference of I think like $40. So D and E, both of this section, both deal with individuals who would be eligible to file under that joint bracket if they filed jointly with the federal government, but you know if they were eligible but didn't file with the federal government, they can choose to file individually or file jointly. That's just laid out there. This was a part of the administration side of it that was missing from the original draft in 115. It's just defining how do you consider joint filers. Section F.
Representative Gumberg.
And that's true through all the brackets. Whether you can file, if you're eligible to file jointly, but you defy, the couple decides to file individually, it's through all the brackets. It's not any one bracket.
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair. Yes, that's correct. You wouldn't be able to, when you're filing your return, they would have to choose, am I filing as an individual or am I filing jointly? Section F deals with non-residents filing jointly, so this is an important section for the administration to have. There will be many individuals that file federal joint returns, and perhaps one of them is a resident and one is a non-resident, or they're both non-residents, but one of them works here and one doesn't. So for the purposes of this section, they will be given the choice to either file individually under Section B, under the individual tax brackets, or to file jointly, but file as a resident, as joint residents under Section C. This has to do with how you apply the allocation of income and what kind of credits you get for where your income comes from. And Mr. Serranos can speak to this more directly on Tuesday, but when we get to the next section, which is 43.22.015, this deals with how a non-resident calculates their tax. Basically, they compute their tax based on all of their taxable income, and then they apply a factor, basically a fraction, their income from a source within the state over their taxable income, and they get to reduce their tax by that amount.
So, Mr. Chairman?
I got a question from Representative Guttenberg and then Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In relating to resident, on page 25, it defines a non-resident individual is an individual who is not a resident of the state for any portion of the taxable year. So so somebody's working in a remote location in Alaska, in a fisheries or on a slope or on a mine. Is the reference here that they don't change their residency, or if somebody's here working for more than 30 days, technically they're a resident?
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, the definition of resident is also linked to the definition of domiciled. And so where you're domiciled has a list of things that indicate there's several indicators of where you're domiciled. That's the type of thing that will indicate that you are a resident. So,
Representative Wilson?
So I just want to be clear. So non-residents can choose whether to file jointly or individual, but Alaskans have to file whatever way they do with the federal government?
They have that choice as well.
Okay, that's not how I understood what was said. Okay, thank you.
I will just double check that language is clear, but I believe they should have that choice.
Page 8, line 26.
Yeah.
Well, that's not a resident. Line 26.
Yeah, I will make sure that language is clear. So when we're looking at non-residents who are filing jointly, whether or not they file jointly has a large impact on that allocation of income that's under Section 015. Because if you're taking all of your taxable income and your income from a source within the state, if only one of the filers worked within the state, well, then the numerator of that fraction is going to be much smaller than the denominator of that fraction. And so they basically be pulling in a bunch of income that's not from within the state, which would have the effect of reducing their taxes because you multiply the taxes by the fraction. So that's why it's a choice to either file individually as a non-resident and apply that allocation of income from Section 015, or to file jointly, and in that case you're filing as residents, but then you're eligible for the resident credit against income taxes paid in other states. Section 43.22.020 is defining the tax on trusts and estates. Again, we'll get into this in more detail on Tuesday. I know there will be some questions, but this basically says that a tax of 7% is imposed on the taxable income of a trust, which is just the income. That's not the principal balance of the trust, it's only the income that trust generates. And then a tax of 2.5% is imposed on the Alaska Native Settlement Trust. They have an alternative tax treatment at the federal level, so that's just being mirrored here. And again, we'll get into more details on it. Trusts are very complicated. The one House Bill 115, the original version, we had tried to take out the reference to trust to try and reduce that, but it was still going to be, that's still income on the federal level, so it's still going to be complicated trying to define. We still had to acknowledge the difference between a resident and a non-resident trust and deal with all that. So this language has been crafted to deal with it very specifically. Resident trusts are defined in the definition section pretty extensively. Resident trusts will be taxed on all their taxable income. Non-resident trusts will be taxed on their income from a source within the state, just as an individual. And trusts that there are certain trusts that are maybe housed here but have no actual taxable nexus in the state, and so those are the trusts that are kind of outlined in subsection B there, that they would not be taxed either. This is the concern that was raised last year about us perhaps losing the trust in industry because people who have no connection to this state would just move there. They don't live in this state. Their income is not from this state. They just have their trust kind of administered in this state. In that sense, the trust itself wouldn't be taxed because otherwise they might choose to move it to Delaware or something. But the income from those people who are residents of the state and perhaps are working on that trust would be taxed as individual income.
Ms. Hansen, I've got a question. So I know with the Alaska Native corporations, as they generate income, they sometimes distribute dividends, and those are taxable at the federal level, and so mm-hmm. those would also be taxable as income under this bill. And I'm familiar with that income, but then the Resident Alaska Native Settlement Trust could generate income. I'm just trying to think of examples of when within the Alaska Native community there are Alaska Native Settlement Trusts. Do you know anything about that?
Representative Foster, through the chair, I'm building up my profile on that right now, and I believe Mr. Spanos will have a few details on that as well. But it, as you see, it's outlined specifically in the federal code. And as you talked about, the money that's distributed to the beneficiaries, basically, of a trust, either one, the beneficiary income is generally considered taxable. But for all trusts, the amount that the trust is taxed is reduced by the amount that they distribute because that money is taxed on the individual level.
Maybe we can come back to that. I'm just trying to get some examples
yeah.
of where this exists and what this is. So anyway, please proceed, unless there are other questions. No.
Section 4322025. This is the credit for income paid in other states. We had a discussion on this. On the previous version, we had a similar credit. This one's been outlined just a little bit clearer. But this is where, when you have a resident, the tax is computed on all of their taxable income, whether from inside the state or out of the state. But if you're paying an income tax in another state on income that you earned in that state, that's connected to that state, you will get a credit against your Alaska state income tax to reduce it. So you're not paying two taxes on the same income. So as I mentioned, Section 4322030 defines taxable income for the purpose of this chapter. It starts as the federal adjusted gross income. That's the basis of this tax. Then we add in a couple items and subtract a couple items. What we add in here is that interest on obligations of another state, so municipal bonds, for example, those items are not taxed at the federal level. You'll see that on line 8B of your 1040 form. It's tax exempt, but it's totally it's allowed to be taxed by the states, and as far as I know, all the other states do tax these, and so residents of other states that currently hold Alaska bonds are paying income tax on those bonds. Similarly, there's some bonds related to the United States that the federal government doesn't tax but allows the states to tax. So that would be added back in. Section C, income taxes under this chapter. Usually your deduction for your state income tax is taken after adjusted gross income when you itemize your deductions. But apparently there are some people who interpret it as being allowed to be taken earlier when they in their business expense calculation. So we would be not allowing a deduction for an Alaska income tax because then it would be circular. But that's not a normal situation. That's a very unusual situation. I'll bring a 1040 in and show you exactly where they would be doing that, and that will help. D is a gain realized but not recognized under U.S. code. So this relates to trade of like-kind real properties, which on the federal level they say you don't have to recognize any of that gain, which means we're not going to tax any of that gain unless it actually comes out as cash. We've chosen to recognize that in consultation with some of our knowledgeable advisors because, for example, we are taxing S corporations and limited liability corporations. If we didn't have this in here, they could trade a rather sizable Alaska property or Alaska oil even is considered in this trade of like-kind property. They could trade it for out of state and then cash it out, and Alaska wouldn't realize any of that gain. And then E is just saying any deductions that somebody has taken on their federal adjusted gross income that is related to income the state can't tax, we won't allow that deduction because it's not on an item that we're going to tax. These are all, several of these deductions would have occurred under the previous version. We just hadn't enumerated them. Mr. Spanos can speak to what the form will look like. It'll be seems complicated, but it'll be a fairly simple form. And then Section 2 is what is being taken out of the federally adjusted gross income. Most of these things are things that we can't tax under federal law, so they, again, would have needed to have been removed under the previous version of the bill. Whether we are doing tax liability or adjusted gross income, we can't tax these items. That's bonds from the state and refunds for an overcredit of an income tax. All right, sorry, not bonds. Bonds from the federal government that aren't taxable by the state. If somebody were to, that gain that I talked about in the previous sections, if they were recognized and paying it on the federal level, then we wouldn't want to tax it twice. And then we can't tax non-resident pensions from non-residents, say if the pension was generated originally from within the state, but now they're a non-resident. Under U.S. law 114, we can't tax that. So that's being exempted. We can't tax the compensation of military members that are posted here but aren't residents. And then we've added two specific exemptions for Alaska, which is the permanent fund dividend that will be exempt from your taxable income and that personal exemption of $4,000 per person.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Wilson?
I just want to make sure I understand. So let's say I lived in Washington before I moved here, and I'm getting a pension check from the company that I worked for in Washington. That won't be taxed underneath this.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, the other way around. You moved from Washington. Your pension is from Washington, but you're now a resident of Alaska. Alaska will tax your pension. Washington is not allowed to tax that pension. Somebody who worked in Alaska and generated a pension here but now lives in, you know, California can tax a portion of their pension. Alaska cannot tax their pension.
And a follow-up?
Follow-up.
How about Social Security?
We're doing adjusted gross income, so a portion of Social Security is exempted from adjusted gross income, and we're not making any change to that. So we will be taxing whatever portion of Social Security income is taxable on the federal level.
Thank you.
Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, thank you. So, and just in a little bit of follow-up, but almost in so we've been talking a little bit about some of the exemptions. I'm trying to is there a way to get a list of maybe all the potential exemptions that are in here? Because it sounds to me like we're not referring to because it's not my federal adjusted gross income that we're basing it off of, right?
Representative Pruitt, to the chair, the base is the federal adjusted gross income. The only changes are the items listed specifically here. So you'll see throughout the bill when talking about what is being taxed, it's called your taxable income.
Right.
Taxable income means federal adjusted gross income with these specific changes.
Okay, so that, and then, Mr. Chair. Okay, so that must be in back in the definition, because that's what I saw was taxable as mm-hmm. well, and I was
It's not referring to federal taxable income. So federal taxable income, they take federal adjusted gross, and then they apply the federal deductions and exemptions, and then you get federal taxable income.
Yeah.
We're taking federal adjusted gross and applying these specific Alaskan modifications and getting Alaska's taxable income.
So can I follow up on that?
Your follow-up.
So I haven't done my own taxes for a few years just because they got too complex and I live in Juneau and it just didn't work. So I'm going to ask, I can't remember, which side of that line does, for instance, mortgage interest fall on?
Mortgage interest is in the itemized deductions on the federal level. So that's after adjusted gross.
So in this particular case, mortgage interest, so just to kind of bring the reality of what mortgage interest, while you can write it off on your federal, in Alaska you will not be able to write it off against your Alaska.
Under the current draft of this bill, yes.
And that would include charitable donations, all those types of things that are in that itemized. They would not be able to write those off on their Alaska state tax. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. One more follow-up.
Your follow-up?
So, and I'm trying to understand, because, you know, obviously there's the kind of the loopholes on the federal side where you've got people that are fairly wealthy, can find their way to adjust down to a point where they pay lower percentages. Without going through all of the situations, do you perceive that happening with what we've got here, that they would still be able to put enough above the line onto the adjusted gross income that we could have some of our wealthier people that are paying lower percentages? I guess, for lack of a better term, it's the Warren Buffett, you know, kind of syndrome where, you know, he's paying less percentage-wise than his secretary.
Representative Pruitt, through the chair, that was part of the intention of going with adjusted gross instead of the federal taxable income. Most of those deductions occur in the itemized deductions or in the fact that capital gains is taxed federally at a lower rate. That can be a big deduction,
right,
which we're not in this case. That application of the lower capital gains tax rate happens at the very end when you're calculating your tax liability. Under adjusted gross income, capital gains income is this considered equal to other forms of income.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. We've got a question from Representative Gren. Is there anybody else?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Yeah, just kind of follow up on exemptions. Looking, where would military pensions fall under?
Representative Gren through the chair, that would depend on their residency status. If they were residents of Alaska, then the military pensions would be taxed if whatever portion of the military pension that is included in adjusted gross income on the federal level.
If it was generated?
It's not about where the pension was generated. It's about where the person is located at the time the tax is being applied. Just like we were talking about, where somebody who generated their pension in Washington but then moves here, Alaska taxes their pension and Washington doesn't.
Because they don't have a state income tax?
True. Let me say, California, somebody who lives in California, you can't say you used to be a resident here and your pension originated here, but now you're not a resident, but I'm still going to tax you. You can only tax the people who are currently residents.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I would just say the limited list of deductions, I think, is the smarter way to go. You exempt the permanent fund dividend. You exempt a few other things. The moment you go the federal way and start allowing a ton of deductions, this room gets filled with a bunch of people who want their special interest deduction, and it becomes a free-for-all. So I personally like this approach better. A few sort of deductions like the dividend and things like that, personally.
And Representative Guerra, through the chair, some of the comments that we received, especially through email, were concerns with the number of deductions and some people did use the term loopholes on the federal level. And so that was the intention behind keeping this list short.
Representative Wilson.
So, Mr. Chairman, thank you. So when this chart was put together on where we are with this bill, did we just use the percent that they tax, or did we look at each one of these and see, and I'll use Missouri as an example. Missouri has a lot of deductions that you're allowed to take. They follow the federal pretty close before they get to the bottom number. So where on here it may show that they are number 16 because they have a 2.33 effective tax rate. They don't do what we're doing here and take little to no exemptions and multiply it by this. So when this chart was put together, is it just based on the percentage at the end, or was that taken into account as well?
So Representative Wilson, through the chair, that chart was generated by the Institute of Taxation and Economic Policy, so they will be able to go into more detail how their model works. But the percentage is based just on the amount of personal income in the state and the amount of revenue from the tax. So it's the percentage of the total, the percent of tax revenue out of the total personal income. So that should take into account in any of the states the deductions, because you're saying what is the effect of your tax? How much revenue is being generated by your tax? So it doesn't matter what your tax rates are for that particular chart. It matters how much revenue is generated and how does that compare with the amount of overall income in your state.
I don't have a follow-up at this point because I think what this appears to be, what I thought it was, is completely different than what it is, because I took it as, if I would file my same taxes in Vermont or Georgia, pick one, and I did this, did my taxes through them, and then I did Alaska, that I would assume by this chart that I would owe less to Alaska, and I'm just not sure that's true.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, on average, it is true, because we have multiple tax brackets, you can't say exactly line by line. Each state has their own tax brackets. And so in some cases, our tax bracket might be higher. In some cases, our tax bracket might be lower. And on that point, in case I don't get to it because it's near the end, we've directed the department to inflation adjust the brackets and the exemption every couple of years. A lot of states don't, which means you have states that have multiple tax brackets, but at this point, a lot of their residents are paying the highest tax bracket because the brackets were created 10, 15 years ago and everybody's income has gone up.
And, Mr. Chairman, I guess my point is when we're going to put charts out and can compare, how good or bad anything is, I think we need to make sure that, because like I said, I understood it to be completely different. I thought it meant that we would be the fourth lowest, and then as you said, it would depend upon what bracket you're in, what portion of it in. Because I have H&R Block on my computer, I'm going to take my income and do it, because they won't charge me until I file, mm-hmm. and just see how it compares to some of these others so I can better understand, relatively, if we're number four, do we end up being more in the middle?
Yeah. Representative Wilson, through the chair. Again, Carl Davis with the Institute of Taxation and Economic Policy, who generated that chart and who we've spoken with previously, will we plan to have him online next week. I will confirm, make sure he's available.
And
So we've got two questions here from Representative Guerra and Seaton. We do need to get onto the floor in 4 minutes, so maybe we'll take these questions and then rush on. I believe we still have floor at 10:30, correct?
It's Thursday.
We have floor tomorrow.
Oh, it's tomorrow. Oh, okay. Oh, good. Well, we'll take as long as we need then. You guys didn't get the memo?
Today, Friday?
Hey, I'm cool with it.
We're into the last 30 days now. Time is relevant. Okay, Representative Guerra.
Oh, I don't know if this helps, but in the footnote on this chart, they did take into account the fact that our tax is going to be based on adjusted gross income without the deductions. They did note that one of the deductions was the permanent fund dividend, so we'll hear from the folks who put the chart together, but I think they did account mm-hmm. for the differences between those states that use a different level of income and Alaska, which uses adjusted gross income.
Yeah, Representative Guerra, through the chair. Yeah, the model, my understanding is the model is based on the overall effect in it, and they take the deductions out.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm just going to point out that this chart is on the effective tax rate, not the statutory tax rate. So if you had you could have a higher statutory tax rate and then a whole lot of deductions to reach your effective tax rate. But this is the effect on the entire population, though. How much is the entire population? Personal income divided by the total amount of taxes collected in that state based on the distribution of taxes and everything. So there's so many different kinds of tax systems that this is looking at the overall effect on the population and what percentage of income they actually pay in the income tax.
Please proceed, Ms. Hansen. Is there another question?
I think Representative Ortiz might have had a question. Am I still this? Okay. All right. So, as I mentioned previously, there's several short sections in here which are just kind of saying, yes, you're going to be taxed as the federal at the federal level. So 4322.035 is taxable incomes of partnerships and S corporations. So basically says when they're taking the adjustments, those deductions that we were discussing, those adjustments will apply to the income or the distributable share of that income as it does at the federal level. Those adjustments would apply to the item that they come from. And then the department will clarify that in regulation. Similarly, when you get to the taxable income of a state trust or beneficiaries in 040, again, it's just saying that the adjustments that you make for those deductions we were just talking about and the reduction that the trust gets for the amount that they distributed out to their beneficiaries will follow the federal rules, and the department will write the regulations to help guide that. 4322.045, this defines the non-resident individual income derived from or connected with a source in the state. We had a similar section in 115. It was shorter, but the intention was the same, to capture the income that is federally taxable and that is considered connected with a source in the state. Working with that's one of the items that we worked with the Department of Revenue and their consultants on to better define the range of income that's connected with a source in the state.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Pruitt.
I just want to step back real quick and looking at S corporations, since that's a pretty big policy shift as well. If an S corporation has to take a loss into the next year, will they be able to deduct that loss?
Representative Pruitt, through the chair, actually that is addressed in the previous section. You'll see in B it says that they can't carry that net operating loss back, but they can carry it forward 5 years.
They They can't carry it back, meaning they can't apply it to
just so under my understanding is under the federal tax code, you in certain situations you can carry an operating loss back and basically get refunds from past taxes paid, and we're not allowing that here, but we are allowing them to carry it forward 5 years.
Follow up. So many S corporations, they may not complete their tax preparation until the October timeframe. They put that extension in place. So therefore, they may pay up front what they expect and then come back in October. They might have a different mindset. So at this point in time, they wouldn't be able to go back and receive a refund for overpayment based on additional time taken to...
Representative Pruitt, through the chair, I believe this is saying you can't go into prior tax years. It's not talking about the prepayments that you've made. And also, in the definition, you'll see taxable year is defined as calendar year or fiscal year, because we do know that S corporations, some partnerships, file their taxes on a fiscal year and not the calendar year.
Right. So again, follow up. Mm-hmm. There are times, because we're talking about various sized businesses here, everything from the very small mom and pop to substantial sized businesses. I know there are situations where an S corporation may have to go back and reanalyze previous years. Sometimes that means they refile with the IRS. Sometimes that's a higher tax, and sometimes that means a refund, or it may be even a wash if they're having to redo several years. In this particular case, If they go back because they have to go back and reanalyze for whatever reason, if they're in a situation where they find that they can't, that there might have been something owed them, we're going to go ahead and that's not a frequent thing, but I don't know that we should penalize them for coming and recognizing that they've got.
Representative Pruitt, through the chair, I believe it's in the administrative section that says if they file an amended return with the. With the federal government, that same amended return will come to us and we will make adjustments. This provision is not talking about going back and matching up expenses in previous years. It's saying you can't take an expense in this year and then say 2 years ago I had profit, so I'm going to take my expense from this year and use it to get a refund from those profitable years.
Thank you.
And since we were on S corporations, I just wanted to say, to my knowledge, all states that file an individual income tax, it applies to S corporations or partnerships. That's how those corporations are set up. In Florida, they don't have an individual income tax, but they have expanded their corporate tax to include these corporations because they don't have an individual income tax. So Alaska is somewhat unique because. Our existing exemption in the corporate income tax for S corporations in these pass-throughs was put in place when we had an individual income tax. We repealed the individual income tax, but didn't repeal that exemption, and so there's been this hole that doesn't exist in most other states. If committee is comfortable with it, I would move past the the income from a source within the state, and if anybody has individual questions later on, or if we can address those sections on Tuesday. Section 4322050, again, is one of those short sections, just clarifying that the department will be able to set regulations to match up how income related to a business that's conducted by a non-resident individual but conducted in the state. So the regulations adopted under this section will have to conform to the deductions that we talked about that create taxable income, and will also have to conform to 4319, which is the multi-state tax compact. So for businesses, that directs how they allocate income between in this state and other states. And again, 4322055 is one of these sections we're looking at non-resident trusts, estates, or beneficiaries on how they define income, the income for those non-resident trusts and estates is only the income that is connected to this, a source in the state. So the saying the department will create regulations to guide that how that taxable income is defined. It's has to conform with the deductions and exemptions that everybody gets under this chapter and conform with the income connected to a source within the state that's outlined. Section 060, which is page 19, this just deals with people who are a resident part of the year and who are not a resident part of the year. You know, maybe they change their residency or they are domiciled in two different states. They spend half of the year here, half of the year there. So this allows us to tax them as a resident on the portion of the year that they are a resident and as a non-resident for the portion of the year that they are a non-resident.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Wilson?
I thought we just said a resident was one dependent upon where their home was. So how can – so would you have to have two homes, one in Alaska and one in – another state to be resident of two states at once?
Representative Wilson, through the chair. Again, one example would be somebody who moved partway through the year. And so in that case, for the first half of the year, they were a resident of this state. And then they moved, they have a permanent home in a different state. This is giving the department guidelines on how to tax them. You wouldn't tax them as a resident for the whole year because they weren't a resident for the whole year. Again, like you mentioned, resident is defined as where they're domiciled. Some people do have two homes, and they spend 6 months here and 6 months there. And so in that case, you know, where their permanent residence is for those 6 months would make those 6 months their taxable year as a resident here, and the other 6 months would be their taxable year in the other state. My understanding is this is, I mean, the more obvious and I think the more typical one is the first one where you have somebody that moves.
Thank you.
4322065 is determination of the taxable year and accounting. It just says whatever you're paying, whatever tax year you're using to pay the federal government, again, this is the calendar year versus fiscal year, that'll be the taxable year that you use for the state. And the method of accounting, again, I think it's more applicable to the entities and not the individual, but there's accrual method is one method that businesses use. So it just says whatever method you use for the federal tax purposes is the method you will use for the state. If you change it between years or partway through the years, the department is going to set out regulations on how to transition between those two. Section 70, this is very similar to the section that was in 115 already that deals with the return and payment of taxes. It says that a person that's required to pay under this chapter will file a return with the department. The return, you know, needs to be made under oath. The tax is due at the same time and in the same manner it's due to the federal government. And this is where we get to the alteration of a tax. Subsection E, a taxpayer shall notify the department in writing of an alteration in or modification of the taxpayer's federal income tax. And then connected to that, subsection F outlines how you would give a refund if there was an overpayment of tax, either just at the state level or through the adjusted federal tax return. And then subsection H says that a taxpayer under this chapter is not required to file a return electronically, but a person that is paid to file returns must file electronically. So in other portions of Chapter 43, we say everybody has to file electronically. That's corporate tax returns. We're saying here an individual filing an individual income tax return will not face that penalty for not filing electronically. However, we do want tax preparers to file electronically, and Mr. Spanos can elaborate on this more, but it's an issue of tax fraud. If you have a tax preparer file electronically, it's a lot harder for them to file a fraudulent return and actually skim some of the refund. That's the summarized version of the conversation I had on that.
Yeah. Representative Pruitt.
Mr. Chair, yeah, and I think for the most part I agree with this. I just want to ask, and you may not have the answer, two different groups of people of making sure that we have concern. What if you're in a small community and someone has the ability to do it, but they don't have very good access? I know in the past we've used that argument when I'm going back a couple years, but there was some concern about people being able to fill out their APOC forms in certain rural communities especially. And so even though it may be a small community, there might be, what if there's a person in that community that does take money for returns, and if they may not have access? And you may not have an answer to that, but that's one concern. The other one would be, what about the volunteer? They do this in as their job, but they're also volunteering, because I know there's some usually around tax season, there's professionals that will go out, and then sometimes they'll do it in urban communities, but again, this is more of concern about some of the places where they may not have access to that. How would we manage that?
Representative Pruitt, through the chair. I believe Mr. Spanos can actually give a personal example. He mentioned having done the volunteer work. I'd have to go back and look at the section that deals with filing electronically in general. I believe there are certain exemptions, but I'll have to go back and check on that. And again, with the individual one, that is something that he has thought through, and I don't have the answer on the tip of my tongue.
Just want to thank you for asking the question, Representative Pruitt. That's also a concern of mine, because in small villages where there's only, like, say, 300 people, and you've got somebody who maybe worked the construction season and they made a little bit of money in the summer, and they're relying on other people for their expertise in that small community, and there might be somebody who, provides, some service for, it could be free or it could be for a small fee, I guess as we move forward, I'll hear what Mr. Spanos has to say, but that could be something where we say, if it's a community under 500 or something, we do something. So anyway, just something to put on the table, but thanks for asking that. Any other questions? Oh, and we do have Mr. Spanos online. Mr. Spanos, did you hear the question?
I did hear the question, yes. For the record, Brandon Spanos, Deputy Director with the Tax Division. And yes, I've done the voluntary income tax preparation in some of the smaller villages. I think the smallest one that I was in was Eek. And in that village, my experience was that those that that wanted to not use the voluntary, the free volunteer income tax preparation, they just they would go to Bethel and get their taxes done there. If there was a paid preparer in a small community, again, this only applies to paid preparers. It does not apply to voluntary preparation. So if I'm just your friend and I'm doing your taxes for you and you don't pay me anything, I don't fall under this provision, so I could file it on paper. If you do it through the voluntary income tax preparation that the IRS or some of the local nonprofits do, again, they can file on paper. But most of those, they fly out there. They do the preparation on a computer. They'll bring the computer back to an urban community and then file all of them electronically, which they can do free with the IRS. So most of those will be electronic anyway. But the current statute that requires electronic filing that was passed in the last session allows for an exemption for those that don't have the capability of filing electronically. So I believe that's already covered. They can file a waiver, and then that waiver applies for 5 years, and then they can file for another waiver. So if they don't have computer connectivity or even a computer, they can file on paper with that waiver, but they have to file a waiver first.
Okay. Thank you. Any further questions? Representative Wilson?
So I have one question. So I always do mine by paper. I never do it electronically. So how would the state know that I went to a preparer and they hand it to me already done to take back with me? I've paid for it. I mean, there's not really a way you're going to be able to follow whether or not I just decide to file it on my own versus I could have done it with H&R Block or, whoever. I mean, how are you going to be able to follow this regulation? Are this part of the statute?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, the paid preparers are required under federal law to sign the return, and they have to have their paid preparer ID number on the return. So if you go into H&R Block and have it prepared and they print it out on paper for you, they have to have their preparer ID on there and sign that they believe that it's true and correct, the information that they received.
Okay, well, that's why I know.
If you had your friend do it and you paid your friend and they didn't sign it, that, of course, we wouldn't know. But if they're able to be receiving payment for filling out a tax return, then they have certain obligations, and they're under federal law required to sign it.
Follow-up, Mr. Chairman?
Follow-up.
So I've known people who've gone and had it done, and then they haven't decided whether or not they have all their paperwork. So basically, as long as they don't completely finish it, I could still take it back with me, fill out my own, because they haven't literally given me a final copy and get around this if I want to.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, so you take the paper that they gave you and fill out your own form?
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, you could do that. But then it wouldn't be filed by the paid preparer.
Right.
So if you were to file it on your own behalf, you could, under this statute, even if this were to pass, still legally do that. We wouldn't go after the paid preparer in that case because they didn't file the return.
And I understand that makes sense, but yeah. I don't go to them anyway, but I just, in case ever I have to, I want to make sure how I can still do it by paper.
Yeah. And Representative Wilson through the chair, if you are the one actually submitting your return, we're not going to have the tax fraud concern that I mentioned earlier because the tax preparer wouldn't have access to your refund. So.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I just didn't understand where the fraud was coming from. I didn't know who was changing the number, so. Thank you.
Okay, so section 075. This is bottom of page 20. This is tax withholding on wages of individuals and independent contractors. Very similar to what was already in House Bill 115. We did make some changes. You might remember the original section of 115 said specifically employers making payments and also those paying for crew shares. That's been taken out. So the first section just deals with every employer making payment of wages or salaries shall deduct and withhold and remit, very similar to how they do federally with a form very similar to the W-2 and the W-4. Subsection B directs the department to publish a rate of withholding required by this section, and then currently says regulations adopted under this section will require a person paying an independent contractor to withhold a portion of the amount paid. Our initial research indicated that there are some other states that do that, and in that case it would be a good way to avoid, you know, to say a non-resident that comes up here and works in the summer and their employer or the person that they're being paid by files the 1099, but the non-resident doesn't file the 1099. We were thinking this might be a good way to capture that tax avoidance. In further research, it seems like it's actually the other states aren't doing withholding on independent contractors, so we're planning on taking that section out. It's just administratively a little bit more burdensome than we first thought. Section 040 is withholding on non-resident partners' composite returns. So, again, this is a very specific item. These are partners that are required to file an annual information return with under subchapter K of the Internal Revenue Code. And so, if they're filing with the federal government, they would be filing a partnership return with the state and would be withholding on the non-resident partner. Section 4322.085 is the permanent fund tax payment. This was in the previous version of 115. It just allows the option to use your dividend as a prepayment, basically, on your taxes. Section 090 is in the administrative section. Again, some of this was in the previous 115 section, but I believe it's been rewritten a little bit. It allows the department to adopt the necessary regulations and forms that they need to move forward with this chapter. It also says that the Internal Revenue Code regulations are considered persuasive authority except for those places where they are inconsistent with this chapter. So I believe that's an efficiency thing for our tax preparers. In most cases, they can just adopt those regulations instead of writing their own. And then subsection B is a tax avoidance section. We've had kind of throughout the chapter references that if there's an allocation of distributed share or allocation of gain or income or loss that's done out of accordance with how that share would normally be considered, if it's just for the purpose of tax avoidance, then the department shall disregard that. Similarly here it says a transaction between two parties has to have an actual business purpose and not just for shifting income to avoid taxes. And then subsection D is what I mentioned earlier about the department will be inflation adjusting the brackets and the exemption biannually so that we don't end up catching more and more people in the upper brackets as their income rises. 095 is just allowing that any references to the Internal Revenue Code that happen throughout the chapter, we basically consider those reference sections as if they were defined in this statute, unless they conflict with the chapter itself. And then 150, we get to the definitions. Again, the definition of resident is connected with the definition of domiciled, which is number one there. It's a long list. Those are indicators of where you're domiciled. They're not, they're not any one item would say, oh, your place of employment is here and therefore you're domiciled here. It just means you might be. And then the definition of resident is on page 26. It's number 18. And the definition of resident individual includes an individual who receives a permanent fund dividend, who receives a tax benefit only available to a resident, to an individual domiciled in the state. That would be specifically like a municipal property tax exemption for having this be your primary residence. Or somebody that's domiciled in the state for the taxable year, unless they maintain a permanent place of abode outside of the state and are only in the state for less than 30 days. So that's, if you have enough of a permanent home established here that you would otherwise be considered domiciled, but you spend less than 30 days here and you have a permanent, and you're domiciled in another state, then you wouldn't fall under that. And then, as I mentioned, some detailed definition of resident trust, because that is a very detail-oriented and complex item. So that is, and then there's one more section, which was in section 20. We spoke to this briefly. That was in the original House Bill 115, and it just ties into that voluntary use of the permanent fund dividend against your tax, allowing the division to put a checkbox on your application.
Okay. That's the CS for 115. Any questions? And
if I may,
we did talk about NOLs, though. That was
And if I may add one thing, as I mentioned, we're planning on having Department of Revenue up. I believe the plan is on Tuesday. If people have questions they want to put down in writing, please feel free to come to me, and I will make sure they get established.
Okay, Representative Seaton. It was a motion to move it before the committee for the purpose of discussion.
Yes, and what I'd like to do is move it as our working document.
There was an objection.
Yeah.
I think it might have been less.
I remove my objection.
Okay, somebody was here.
Just trying to make sure we could have the working document so that when people are coming and testifying, they know what our working document currently is.
Okay, so we had a motion to move it and before the committee, and you've removed your objection. And so now there
Mr. Chair, I'll object just for one point.
Sure. I do want to highlight that I think this is I think this is the first bill where we've had a CS this year that we introduced. I thought that the idea was that anything that was amended in bills this year was going to be through amendments, not the CS. So this is the first time I think that we've seen one that was just done with a CS where the changes were made. So I'm going to remove my objection because I just wanted to kind of highlight that this is kind of a little bit of a shift in how the committee is handling this one as opposed to some of the others. And I don't know when we should plan on certain ones being amended or through the amendment process as opposed to, which I expect we'll be able to amend these sections. I'm not arguing that piece, but and when it will be done in a CS. So it kind of confused me. That's with that, I remove the objection.
Representative Wilson?
I'm going to object for a moment because we had a discussion earlier that when a bill got substantially changed, how that would affect public testimony. This is substantially changed. This puts trust in. This puts S corporations in it. It's now bracketed. And so those who may have thought they were going to be affected in a different fashion, and I still don't know all the ramifications because we just got it last night, and I do appreciate that a copy was brought to us last night so we had an opportunity to at least get an idea of what it does. But and this is your call, Mr. Chairman, whether or not it's substantial enough to where the public, you know, after we have all the conversation, I mean, I'm not going to say they're going to love it or not, but this affects a lot of entities that the first one did not, and so there could be groups that did not testify last time because, for instance, trust was not in it. So yeah. I'll remove my objection to have this as a working draft so people know what's in front of us, but I am very concerned that if we're not going to open this back up for public testimony, that somehow the word gets out so those who are now affected will have an opportunity to give us a very clear picture of how negative that would do, especially when we're talking about people being exempt underneath some of the federal laws, that this won't affect companies that won't be, whether those are LLCs or whoever they are on that. I know I need to understand better what companies will be affected by this, and one, because of the federal government, because of their law, will not be, and whether or not there's going to be a disadvantage because of that. But that's your call, but I'll remove my objection for this, but this is substantial.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. Did you have a comment, Representative Seaton?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, and I announced earlier in the week that we were rolling all of the amendments that we had adopted to the permanent fund sections in, yes. And that we were going to, since we were totally replacing that, we would roll it into a CS, but it would be considered like an amendment because it was going to be, you know, it's going to have to be fully considered. So there's no in this CS. That's why I announced it earlier in the week that that's what we were going to do. But thank you. I just wanted to clarify that.
Just procedurally, so this was a motion to move it so that we could have discussion and present it. And do we need a separate motion to adopt it as our working CS?
We
no.
did.
Okay. So if there are Ms. Hansen?
I just wanted to make a quick clarification. She wrote her question. And Representative Wilson through the chair, S corporations and partnerships actually were in the previous draft. They just weren't very well outlined. And trusts were not specifically in or out. And our understanding from working with the Department of Revenue was that wasn't helpful on either. That because trust income is federally taxable, then the Department of Revenue would be deciding. They would be making the assumption that income under tax liability would potentially be taxable, but it would be on the department to decide that. And so potentially trusts were in the previous version. They just weren't outlined very clearly.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Wilson?
I just know enough to be dangerous when it comes to trusts. And so I know there's a lot of trusts in this state because of the way that we have handled taxation for it that also does bring, from my understanding, brings revenue to the state. And if those people leave, that will be a negative, not a positive.
And I just don't know at this point, and I got my experts to go to after today, to find out how this affects those trusts coming here and whether or not it may not affect them at all. I just need to find out. So now that it's completely in there, we need to find it, those things.
And just to be clear, we do have public testimony scheduled for next Wednesday on this bill. So, and also wanted to clarify that the secondary motion that I made was to adopt this as a working draft, and there was an objection, and it was removed. Was that done properly? We're fine. Okay, so we have this before us as a working draft.
What time on Wednesday is the public testimony?
I say it's Thursday. We'll know today. We'll know later today. It's Thursday.
Okay, at 1:30. I'm just going to write down.
And our next meeting here is going to be 1:30 this afternoon, and we'll be hearing from LBNA's consultant, Rich Ruggiero, from Castle Gap Advisors on House Bill 111. That'll be at 1:30, Rich Ruggiero, consultant here. And so if nothing else, we'll be adjourned at 11 o'clock.